The bombing of Baghdad was a sign that Clinton, facing several foreign policy crises during his two terms in office, would react to them in traditional ways, usually involving military action, claiming humanitarian motives, and often with disastrous results for people abroad as well as for the United States. In Somalia, East Africa, in June 1993, with a country in a civil war and people desperate for food, the United States intervened late and badly. As journalist Scott Peterson wrote in his book, Me Against My Brother, at war in Somalia, Sudan, and Rwanda, American and other foreign forces in Somalia committed startling acts of savagery, hiding behind the banner of the United Nations. The Clinton administration made the mistake of intervening in an internal conflict between warlords. It decided to hunt down the most prominent of these, General Mohamed Aidid, in a military operation that ended with the killing of 19 Americans and perhaps 2,000 Somalis in October 1993. The attention of the American public was concentrated, as usual, on the deaths of Americans, glamorized in the film Black Hawk Down. The lives of Somalis seemed much less important. As Peterson wrote, American and UN officers made clear that numbers of Somali dead did not interest them, and they kept no count. In fact, the killing of the American Rangers by an angry Somali mob was preceded months before by a critical decision made by the United States to launch a military attack on a house in which tribal elders were meeting. It was a brutal operation. First, Cobra attack helicopters launched anti-tank missiles. Minutes later, Peterson reports, American ground troops stormed in and began finishing off the survivors, a charge U.S. commanders deny. But a survivor of the raid told Peterson, if they saw people shouting, they killed them. U.S. General Thomas Montgomery called the attack legitimate because they were all bad guys. Admiral Jonathan Howe, representing the U.N. operation, because the United States had insisted an American must be in charge, defended the attack by saying the house was a very key terrorist planning cell and denied the civilians had died, though it was clear that the dead were tribal elders. The claim was that tactical radios were found in the compound later, but Peterson wrote, I have never heard nor seen any evidence that this attack even remotely met a single criteria of direct military advantage. Peterson commented, though we all had eyes and had witnessed the crime, mission commanders defended the indefensible and stubbornly clung to the illusion that more war could somehow bring peace. They thought that Somalis would forget the carnage, forget the spilled blood of their fathers and brothers. The Somalis did not forget, and the killing of the American Rangers in October was one consequence. The catastrophic policy in Somalia led to another one the following year in Rwanda, where famine and murderous tribal warfare were ignored. There was a UN force in Rwanda that might have saved tens of thousands of lives, but the United States insisted that it be cut back to a skeleton force. The result was genocide. At least 1 million Rwandans died. As Richard Heaps, a consultant to the Ford Foundation on Africa, wrote to the New York Times, the Clinton administration took the lead in opposing international action. When, shortly after, the Clinton administration did intervene with military force in Bosnia, journalist Scott Peterson, who had by this time moved to the Balkans, commented on the difference in reactions to genocide in Africa and in Europe. He said that it was as if a decision had been made somewhere that Africa and Africans were not worth justice. Clinton's foreign policy had very much the traditional bipartisan emphasis on maintaining friendly relations with whatever governments were in power and promoting profitable trade arrangements with them, whatever their record in protecting human rights. Thus, aid to Indonesia continued, despite that country's record of mass murder. Perhaps 200,000 killed out of a population of 700,000 in the invasion and occupation of East Timor. Democrats and Republicans joined forces as the Senate defeated a proposal to prohibit the sale of lethal weapons to the Suharto regime of Indonesia. The Boston Globe wrote, July 11, 1994, "The arguments presented by senators, solicitors of Suharto's regime, and of defense contractors, oil companies, and mining concerns doing business with Jakarta, made Americans seem a people willing to overlook genocide for the sake of commerce." Secretary of State Warren Christopher made the all-too-familiar claim that Indonesia's respect for human rights is improving. This was the Clinton administration's rationale for pursuing business as usual with Suharto and his generals. In 1996, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to José Ramos Horta of East Timor. Speaking at a church in Brooklyn shortly before he won the prize, Ramos Horta said, "In the summer of 1977, I was here in New York when I received a message telling me that one of my sisters, Maria, 21 years old, had been killed in an aircraft bombing. The aircraft, named Bronco, was supplied by the United States." Within months, a report about a brother, Guy, 17 years old, killed along with many other people in his village by Bell helicopters supplied by the United States. Same year, another brother, Nunu, captured and executed with an American-made M-16. Similarly, American-made Sikorsky helicopters were used by Turkey to destroy the villages of rebellious Kurds in what writer John Tierman, in his book Spoils of War, The Human Cost of the Arms Trade, called a campaign of terror against the Kurdish people. By early 1997, the United States was selling more arms abroad than all other nations combined. Lawrence Korb, a Department of Defense official under Reagan, but later a critic of arms sales, wrote, "It has become a money game, an absurd spiral in which we export arms only to have to develop more sophisticated ones to counter those spread out all over the world." Finally, in the last year of the Clinton administration, when mass resistance in East Timor brought about a referendum for independence, military aid stopped, and the Suharto regime collapsed. At last, East Timor appeared to be winning its freedom. But military power continued to dominate policy, and the United States often stood alone in refusing to cut back on its weaponry. Though 100 nations signed an agreement to abolish landmines, which were killing tens of thousands of people each year, the United States refused to go along. Though the Red Cross urged governments to suspend the use of cluster bombs, which spewed out thousands of tiny pellets, killing indiscriminately, the United States, which had used cluster bombs in Vietnam and in the Gulf War, refused to desist. At a UN conference in Rome in 1999, the United States opposed the establishment of a permanent international war crimes court. There was fear that American officials and military leaders, who, like Henry Kissinger, had been responsible for policies leading to the deaths of large numbers of people, might be brought before such a court. Human rights clearly came second to business profit in U.S. foreign policy. When the international group Human Rights Watch issued its 1996 annual report, the New York Times summarized its findings. The organization strongly criticized many powerful nations, particularly the United States, accusing them of failing to press governments in China, Indonesia, Mexico, Nigeria, and Saudi Arabia to improve human rights for fear of losing access to lucrative markets. This criticism was borne out by the Clinton administration's bizarre approach to two nations, China and Cuba, both of which considered themselves communist. China had massacred protesting students in Beijing in 1991 and put dissenters in prison. Yet the United States continued to give China economic aid and certain trade privileges, most favored nation status, for the sake of U.S. business interests. Cuba had imprisoned critics of the regime, but had no bloody record of suppression, as did Communist China or other governments in the world that received U.S. aid. But the Clinton administration continued, and even extended, a blockade of Cuba that was depriving its population of food and medicine. In its relations with Russia, a concern for stability over morality seemed to motivate the Clinton administration. It insisted on firm support for the regime of Boris Yeltsin, even after Russia initiated a brutal invasion and bombardment of the outlying region of Chechnya, which wanted independence. Both Clinton and Yeltsin, on the occasion of the death of Richard Nixon, expressed admiration for the man who had continued the war in Vietnam, who had violated his oath of office, and who had escaped criminal charges only because he was pardoned by his own vice president. Yeltsin called Nixon one of the greatest politicians in the world, and Clinton said that Nixon, throughout his career, remained a fierce advocate for freedom and democracy around the world.